Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, here he is, Brock Romanek with his Big Legal Minds podcast.
Welcome to Big Legal Minds. I'm Brock Romanek, editor of thecorporatecounsel.net, deallawyers.com, and compensationstandards.com. My guest today, Brink Dickerson of Troutman Sanders in Atlanta, is truly a big legal mind. With over 30 years of practice under his belt, Brink is one of those rare lawyers who really cares about the profession and takes the time to consider what might be a better way of doing it. This is always the case, whether he's helping a client draft their SEC disclosures, or he's mulling over a SEC rule proposal and how might the proposal best be tweaked. A longtime member of the advisory board for thecorporatecounsel.net, Brink is constantly feeding me new ideas or ways to approach an issue that is vexing our corporate law community. To put it mildly, Brink loves the challenges in drafting. One of the foremost experts in MD&A, Brink takes the time to draft his law firm memos so that they are easier to understand, but yet are very practical. Hi, it's Brock Romanek, thecorporatecounsel.net, Big Legal Minds, and I'm here in the beautiful offices of Troutman Sanders in D.C. across from the FBI headquarters. Scary, but Brink, as you heard, is from Atlanta. But before we get into that, Brink, where did you grow up?
Well, my dad was part of corporate America, so every time he was promoted, it was another move. And we started when I was born in San Francisco and spent time in Des Moines and Milwaukee and Cleveland and Savannah, and finally settled down in Atlanta when I was in high school.
So that's a lot of jumping around for back in the day when people typically had one job for their career.
It was, and he really only had two jobs. It was just the way at the time he started with General Motors, and if you worked for General Motors and you got a promotion, you were going to move, and it was just part of life. And as my mother used to joke, that meant she got new appliances every 2 years, and life was good.
So which of those cities, which would probably more relate to which of those years in school was your favorite?
It was certainly Atlanta. I went to high school in Atlanta and ended up staying there through college and graduate school. Savannah was a great place to live. If people listening to this podcast haven't spent much time in Savannah, it's worthy of a detour. It's a beautiful town with good food and a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah, I was recently at the Kimpton Hotel there, which is down the street from SCAD, which is the Savannah
College of Art and
College
Design.
Right, beautiful. Yeah, and I agree. It's a great place. And you can bring your pets at Kimpton. If you haven't been to a Kimpton anywhere in the U.S., it's a boutique chain. So now whenever I go somewhere, I actually try to stay in a Kimpton. It's high quality, and they're very nice.
Well, I think everybody, when they think of traveling in that part of the country, think of Charleston. And Charleston's a great city as well. I spent a summer camp at the Citadel, which is a story in itself. But Savannah has a quaintness and a walkability that's hard to beat. And don't go in August, but 11 months of the year, it's a great place to be.
So this next question could be my favorite one that I've asked anyone so far. I understand that you may be the only securities law in America without a customary qualification. So you drafted this question.
Yeah, I did. You asked me what to ask. I am probably the only high school dropout that you know.
Wow.
I finished the 11th grade and quit school and started college after that, and never have had a high school diploma or a GRE. It's only presented a problem one time. Usually when you apply for credit, they ask you what's the highest degree you obtained, and so you can say graduate or postgraduate, depending on what they ask. If you apply for a Sears credit card, they ask simply, did you graduate from high school? And at the point I applied for a Sears card, I was already practicing law, so I just said yes and moved on.
You're the rebel. So for years, I used to have a nightmare that I'd wake up from, in which I think I'm in college now and I get a letter or a call saying that I didn't have enough credits to graduate high school and I have to go back, and I go back and I'm the old guy and everyone's, you know, looking at me in the hall.
You would have had fun.
But that's your real life. That's not your nightmare.
That's, and it worked fine. It was I went to a school that was an ex-military high school, and it was not the most fun place to go. And college, where you could go to class and go have a beer at lunch, was a whole lot better.
Did your parents think you were crazy?
No, my parents, my dad viewed it as getting a discount because I was going to a private school, and so he figured he saved a year's tuition by my starting college a year early. My mother's insistence was if I was going to do that, she wanted me to go to college close to home, which is why I ended up at Emory rather than someplace else. And they also were very passionate that I finished college in 4 years, because somebody without both a high school diploma and a college degree at that point would have been unemployable.
So how did you decide to go to law school?
Well, you know, I always wanted to be a lawyer, and most of the people listening to this won't relate to this. Fortunately, you're old enough, you may. There used to be a TV show called Hazel. And Hazel was the nanny, the housekeeper for a family called the Baxters. And Mr. Baxter was a corporate lawyer. And he lived in a nice red brick colonial home and had a nice lifestyle and a pretty wife and a good job. And I always thought that was pretty cool. And other people may have liked Judd for the Defense or today some of the other lawyer shows, but I thought that was the way to go.
I haven't heard of that one. I was actually in the era of L.A. Law, so that was the late 80s. And then I know Allie McBeal threw another group of kids into law school as well. Those are the two biggies.
And you know, it's amazing what sort of career influence shows can have in that regard. So it was a positive goal from a very early time. I paused for a while. I got my MBA before I went to law school. I thought for a moment of going into business instead, but got back on track and finished out appropriately.
So I know you've been in Atlanta for a long time, but you did practice in Chicago for quite a while. What
I did. You know, one of the misfortunes of law school is you got to get a job. And the year that I finished Emory, my first goal would have been to have stayed in Atlanta, but the Atlanta legal market was so attractive to everybody in the country that the fairly finite number of good jobs were absorbed by people from Harvard and Yale and NYU and Columbia, leaving only a handful for the people from Emory and the University of Georgia. And we decided, my wife and I decided, it'd be better to go to a market where I could get a better job than it would be to get a job in Atlanta that wasn't going to end up with the kind of experience and kind of work that I wanted to do. So we looked at Dallas and Chicago, a little bit in New York. New York was not our first choice just from a lifestyle perspective. And we ended up in Chicago, and it worked out well.
And that's a big deal to switch then from Chicago after you were there 13 years, I think.
I was there 16 years, a long time. Mm-hmm. I tried earlier than that. My wife and family were all sort of cheerleading for a return to Atlanta, and Atlanta was a closed legal market at the time. Laterals were not welcome, and I went back and plowed forth in Chicago, and a few years later a client of ours decided to relocate to Atlanta, and there's nothing that will get you a job faster than showing up with a public client who needs $1 million of work a year. And with that, I had credibility and made the move in 1998, and we've been there since then.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't heard before that certain markets were closed to laterals, but that makes sense.
It's less closed now. I mean, Atlanta's growing quickly again, and it needs legal talent. And in particular, it needs to backfill from the years post-recession when unfortunately, there aren't many survivors from the law school classes of, you know, 06 and 07 and 08. And so there's
they open ice cream shops instead.
Those were sad years, and I still regret sort of how the marketplace dealt with that.
So what early experiences shaped how you practiced law?
Well, I had the good fortune when I ended up in Chicago of working for a firm that's now part of Quarles and Brady. And at the time, all the associates had to rotate. You spent 3 months doing one type of law and 3 months doing another type of law. And at the end of the second year, you were picked a specialty and you went with it. And a byproduct of that was, you know, I spent 3 months doing estate planning. And estate planners will remind you that when your work product's examined, it's probably because the client's dead. and he's not going to be there to interpret what he meant and what you said. And it forced you to think about drafting in a very, very precise sort of way. I spent 3 months doing Arthur Andersen securities defense litigation, and there, you know, had a good mentor who viewed as his goal making sure that I knew how the different liability provisions in the 33 and the 34 Act interlaced and developed and evolved and what the current state of the law was. I had to spend 3 months doing real estate.
And some leases. People out there are saying, who's Arthur Andersen?
That's right. That's right.
CNN.
Interestingly, there is now a tax firm called Arthur Andersen Tax Services on the West Coast that's a bunch of Andersen alums. So there is a life after that process. That process created more of a foundation for thinking about things and working through problems than when you're siloed. And to this day, I look back at it and can relate some of what I do to some of what I learned then. I mean, for instance, when I draft a document today, I do not define terms that have obvious meanings. I think it needs to be readable and presentable, and if you start defining things like SEC or IRS, that people obviously know what you mean, you just complicate things. And that's a byproduct of working for a guy who wanted you to draft well.
I really wish people would do that in their law firm memos. I don't understand why people would define SEC in a memo. Obviously, if you're reading it, you're in that area of law.
Well, and not to give any trade secrets away on e-alerts, if the first sentence or two on an e-alert isn't simple and intriguing, nobody's going to read the rest of it. And, you know, two-thirds of the things you read out there, you don't make it past the first two sentences.
Yeah, your alerts are definitely among the best because they read like a blog. You're speaking, writing like a, write like you speak. That's what I always say. So do you feel like your experiences that you've had there, what I call PTSD experiences, traumatic, inform your way of learning more than the positive experiences?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm sure I've had my fair share of screw-ups and close calls. I don't think I've committed malpractice yet, and I aspire not to do so in the next 10 years so I can retire with a clean record. Some of the things I did were for clients, in particular clients, weren't so much traumatic, but they did drive some of the ways that you look at things. I mean, for instance, when I was in Chicago, I spent 10 years doing work for the Chicago Bears. And it was not just a fun client, but anytime you did anything for them, you knew you were going to read about it in the newspaper if you screwed up. And so you needed to be very, very thoughtful about how things would be perceived. I worked on the Wicks Lumber Company LBO, and after that transaction was complete, they didn't have a general counsel for the first 5 or 6 months, so I filled in. And you learn incrementally from each of those opportunities if you allow yourself the time to sort of take the deeper dive. So just as my early career was shaped by getting a wonderful cross-section of training, I think my middle career was shaped by a half a dozen or so, maybe more, particular client experiences that invested in me more responsibility and more need to perform at a higher level.
So I know that you've considered working at the SEC at some point, which I'm actually surprised more people don't consider, but some people do, and actually you were considering at a really high level, I think.
I was. I think working at the SEC would have been wonderful. In hindsight, if I knew when I finished law school what I know today, I might very well have tried to get a job there then. It so happened that when Linda Quinn was stepping down and the position at the head of Corp Fin was available, I interviewed. And Arthur Levitt was the chairman at the time, and he interviewed with his staff, and then I came back and interviewed with him, and then I interviewed with the other commissioners. And ultimately, Brian Lane got the job, which was probably for the better. But it was, at that point in my career, the opportunity to make a contribution back. And I'd been fortunate then, and I wanted to do that. I'd like to do that even now, so you know the commitment's still there. It was interesting, though, as Brian's career evolved at the SEC, and particularly with the aircraft carrier. In the aircraft carrier, he did something that was sort of on my list. I don't think I would have done it as artfully or as thoughtfully as he did. He had a lot of experience that it reflected, but it did reflect some of the same sorts of repairs that I thought needed to be done to the overall offering regime. And as you know, the aircraft carrier didn't make it out of the harbor. I worry that if I had been the promoter of it, it might not have made it away from the dock or even into the water. But it was the right approach, and he did a good effort. And it's interesting that subsequently, even though it took 10 years or so, many of the recommendations that he had in the aircraft carrier release have been adopted, and they made the system stronger. But I do think giving back, writing, helping to evolve the state of thought in the security disclosure realm, working for the SEC, doing things like that for the 2 or 3 years or 4 or 5 years that you can give are a great way to promote our trade, our craft, the goals of our clients, and ultimately your career. You don't hear about many people who go do a stint at the SEC after 5 or 6 years in private practice not having a long list of job offers when they come out.
Yeah.
I mean, they are a hot commodity. So it's a positive, and I wish more people would consider it.
Yeah, having actually, I would have worked for you if you had gotten the job.
Well, they did offer me a consolation prize. they offered me another job at the time, but the passion wasn't there for that one.
But I think part of it was the optics. One of the reasons the aircraft carrier initially got rejected was they double spaced the concept release, but it looked so big. And what Keith is doing now, Keith and the commissioners and whoever's in charge, they're doing this disclosure effectiveness projects, but they're doing it in chunks, so that if they came out with all of it at once, you know, these days with all the regulatory requirements with rulemaking, it would be like a 2,000 page release. But here you have these chunks, and so
well, part of the challenge that he had with it was you know, sometimes you do a project and you have it designed in a way that there's something in it that everybody would like, and in his case he did that, but unfortunately there were so many different components of it, there was something in it that everybody could dislike too. And it attracted barnacles. And after you start adding barnacles to any project, it makes it harder to get it underway. And I think that the current effort to divide it up, break it down into components, and see if we can improve each of the components is a positive approach.
So I know you've been a regular on the SEC Institute's very practical programming as speaker. What is it about speaking, or what's your approach to speaking?
Well, I enjoy speaking. It's a time sink, and you know, you can it can kill your billable hours faster than about anything else. But I do enjoy it. I prefer to speak to audiences that want to hear what you have to say, and aren't there on December 31st to knock out their CPE that they've let lapse over the course of the year. I also prefer to talk to groups that are finance and accounting and reporting people. The message that I usually convey is designed for them, and it's less attorney-centric than it is pragmatic, and so that's my favorite audience. I try to speak about things I know something about. I don't speak from notes. I might have a 3x5 card just to make sure I don't miss a topic. And so I need to be prepared to stand in front of them for 45 minutes or an hour and talk about the topic and have a pretty good understanding of it.
And you're standing up.
And I'm standing up.
That's great.
A small detour. I was the first time I ever spoke to a huge audience was one of the national partner meetings for one of the big four accounting firms. And it was in a hotel ballroom and probably had 1,000, 1,500 people in it. And I went early, and I put my glass of water down where I wanted it and mic'd up and got ready. And then I come out 15 minutes later for my 45 minutes, and I'm in spotlights, and I can't see a person, not a soul. You could have told me there were 5 people in the audience, and I would have believed you. And my way of speaking is that I talk to the audience. I pick out somebody, and we sort of have a conversation, even though they don't know it, for a while, and then I'll move on and talk to the other side of the room. And it took me a minute or two Fortunately, I knew what the first couple sentences I wanted to say were, because it took me a minute or two to even be able to function with the bright lights in my face. It gave me a lot of respect for politicians, believe it or not. I mean, they speak in that environment day after day on their feet and do a remarkably good job, or at least most of them do. Speaking is an art, and I'm not as good as they are, but I do try to do it.
It does take practice. I think the speaker has an obligation to bring a lot of energy to it, because it's true, you do feed off the audience. So having, to me, when I speak in front of 2,000 in front of our conference, you can't feel the energy of the crowd. It's much easier if it's like 300 or fewer. And then, of course, the best is 20 people where you can really make it.
Well, and sometimes you get an audience that's just a dud. I mean, and there's not a thing you can do. And then the next audience is very into it, and people will start asking good questions, and two or three good questions will breed 5 or 10 more. And all of a sudden, it's a positive experience for everybody. I try to be a little humorous. I don't, I do tell jokes occasionally, but more self-deprecation, more just making light of the obvious, and try to give the audience a takeaway. I don't expect, as you know and have heard me talk about, my main topic is talking about drafting good MD&As. And that's really just a place saver. I mean, it's really how to draft good disclosure. And I like crisp, transparent, thoughtful disclosure. And if the audience can leave that event with one takeaway or two takeaways to improve just incrementally what they do, we'll be better off, because next time they come back, they'll pick up something else and they'll improve it incrementally again. And I do think the state of art of the art of the U.S. disclosure is dramatically better today than it was 5 or 10 years ago.
Oh, sure.
So it is headed in the right direction.
So what types of tasks are your favorite to work on? Estate planning?
Oh, listen, I wish I had an estate I could plan, and then we would get there. That's a hard question. I've never walked into work. I've never had a morning where I woke up where I wasn't excited about going into work. I'm far from a workaholic. My hours would prove that. But at the same point, I've always enjoyed what I do and wanted to get there and get it done. And when I've had slow moments, I've been able to sit back and write something or prepare some sort of a seminar that I've wanted to teach but really hadn't had the time to prepare. So it's been productive time. I probably, given a choice between projects, would prefer one of a couple things. I like things that are very complicated. I like a new securities offering that nobody's tried before, or a tender offer that, is slightly coercive but in a positive sort of way. I mean, I prefer things that have a little bit of difference to them that you have to think through carefully. I also like things where I'm given the opportunity to counsel. And when you've done this for 35 years, counseling is an important part, or you probably wouldn't have survived that long. And it is personally satisfying for somebody to call up and say, we need your advice. What should we do? How should we think about this problem? What do we need to disclose? What would other clients be doing? And it's rewarding. It's why you went to law school. It takes a while to get there. You just have to be patient.
What about your least favorite?
Well, I'm going to tell you something that won't surprise you, since you know me, but is not going to be what you normally expect. I don't like working with assholes. I've been doing this 30 years. I get to pick who my clients are a little bit at this point. I don't want to work with people who are unpleasant. Life's too short. I avoid them. You can't avoid them perfectly. You got to deal with it sometimes. You just hope to temper it and maybe convert them a little bit and move on to the next project. So when it comes to the things I don't like, I bet half of it or two-thirds of it is people-centric.
And maybe I've been good at avoiding them, but I feel like there's fewer of them than there used to be.
I don't know. I think you're leading a sheltered life.
Okay.
And there are places. We finished a transaction for a client a couple years ago where we had the good fortune of being able to influence who the counsel for the other side was. And the client called up and said, well, who do you want to use? And or who do you think they should use? And it was going to be a New York firm, and we picked a firm that we thought was collegial and would be professional and drive a hard bargain and do a good job for their client, but would be pleasant to work with. And it worked out that way. I can give you examples of working with other firms where it's just miserable from the first email.
Yeah.
Didn't get any better.
I wonder if there's anyone out there who does like working with assholes. Maybe assholes like working with each other. I don't know. Maybe they do.
It's been 10 or 15 years ago. Well, but maybe not that long. It's been 8 or 10 years ago, and we were finishing up a project, and we were trying to figure out how much to bill for it. And it wasn't a huge project. It was about $100,000. And we ended up billing $125,000. And the client asked, it had always been agreed that it would be a negotiated amount at the end of the transaction. And the client asked, well, how did you come up with $125,000? I said it was going to be $100,000, but you know, the other side was a bunch of jerks and it was really worth $125,000. And he never argued. They paid the bill and they were happy to do that.
The asshole premium. So let's talk about the state of securities regulation. We're in a different, that era of Arthur Levitt is so different than the politicized what's going on here in D.C. in general, but also at the SEC. I don't know if it'll ever change or it'll get worse or get better. I guess one or the other will happen. But what's your take?
Well, I think there's, I have one thought that sort of overrides everything. And I'll get to the political issue in just a second. We're dealing with laws that were written in 1933 and 1934 and 35, I guess, was repealed, but 39 and 40. And they're a little bit obsolete right now. And there was a good effort 30 or 40 years ago to create a securities code to rethink the reporting chunks and how they fit together. I had the good fortune of working for the guy in Chicago who wrote the report that led to integrated disclosure, Milton Cohen, and worked for Milton for a number of years, and have thought through, because of his influence, sort of bigger picture disclosure issues. I also head up our firm's technology effort, and I think I'm a little bit like a technophile, and I think about millennials a lot. And we have a paper designed system that's 80 years old that just doesn't fit anymore. And we have decision makers who are largely millennials. I think I saw the other day that there are 60,000 more millennial decision makers every year. I mean, they are growing into the era where they are the guys that make the decision. And I think we need to rethink it. I think we need to be electronic centric first, paper second. We need to think about how we convey information in blocks that are identifiable and usable. And then we need to hang the pieces of our system from that. Milton Cohen's recommendation or comment one day was that if you'd reversed and done the 34 Act first and then the 33 Act, our system would look different today. Mm. And I think to some extent it's time. It would be a many, many million dollar study project to create the sort of commission that would be necessary to do it. We've done it before. We rewrote the bankruptcy code in a very good way, probably in the early 1980s, late 70s. We need to do that with the securities laws, and it needs to be a project that's completed in the next 8 or 10 years, and it needs to be technologically driven.
So it's a much bigger project than this disclosure effectiveness project.
Well, you're nipping at the edges of some of the little problems, but when you have a system that's predicated on your annual 10K as your starting point and not predicated on blocks of information that are available on their website, you're not in tune with America. Now, a lot of what we do is built on the way it's built in order to make sure the liability provisions work right. And you think about the rewrite to the offering system 8 or 10 years ago, they had to create fictions in order to make sure that Section 11 and Section 10, Section 18 still worked with the things that were being filed and taken off the shelf. We need to fix that. We need to just go ahead and say, certain things on your you post certain things on your website, you keep permanent records, those things generate liability in a particular fashion, and then let's go do stock offerings from them or debt offerings. So I think it's time to truly rethink that. But at the same point, I struggle, and you mentioned at the beginning of the question, with the politicization of the process. The SEC is doing a really good job. I don't think people who are removed from it appreciate how good a job they're doing. I mean, Keith Higgins has the Division of Corporation Finance running very well right now. I think the chairwoman is doing an admirable job. I mean, she is a former cop, and she has a good attitude about it. I appreciate that the criticism from time to time that nobody went to jail from the recession and the mortgage fiasco and all the other things that went wrong, and certainly somebody should have. Though I think that predated her largely, and by the time she got there, it was a day late and a dollar short. But the commission's been asked to take on tasks that don't have at their core the protection of little investors. The commission is never going to be an expert in conflict minerals. They're never going to be the expert in extracting resources. They're never going to be an expert on a range of six or seven topics that different interest groups have wanted public disclosure on. And maybe they're the repository, and maybe that's not fixable because of the political process, but we can't overlook what their primary purpose is, which is to make sure that the little investors are protected. And every day when we think about a disclosure document, it's not written for our grandparents and our parents, it's written for professional investors, but we have to make sure that it has the candor and transparency so that anybody who picks it up can get a fair assessment of the company.
So we're going to switch gears here to the four questions here at the end of every podcast. If you could do it all over again, another career choice, what would you be?
I think I'd still be a lawyer, but as I mentioned, I think I would have started in D.C. at the SEC for a couple of years first. And
not a zookeeper?
No. I'm happy with my skin. I'm okay where I'm doing, and it saddens me a little bit when I talk to younger attorneys, and they don't see themselves doing what I'm doing in 20 or 30 years, and they don't want to work that hard that long. They want a different work-life balance, and I sort of wonder what it means for the profession, and hopefully enough of the good ones will share the goals and be there for the long haul.
So right before we started, you were talking about my recent Switzerland video where I was sort of tricked into jumping off a cliff and paragliding. What's the coolest thing you've ever done? I don't mean to phrase that question to compare that experience, but that's the coolest thing I've ever done.
I got it. Listen, I saw your videos, and I was wondering if you needed to get a psychiatric exam to check your judgment. I wouldn't jump off a cliff. I don't know. I'm a passionate snow skier, and I don't ski out of bounds anymore. I've conceded that to younger people, but I have skied in South America a couple of times, and you know, going into a different country and a different set of hills that have things you don't necessarily expect was pretty exciting. That's probably as close as I get to what you did. It reflects better judgment than you exercised when you did that, but I don't have the cool videos to show for it.
Yeah. You need the video. So what's the top item on your bucket list? What's something you want to do?
Traditionally, it relates to travel related. I mean, it's places I want to go and things I want to see. And traditionally, it's been I wanted to spend some time in Cuba. And now since I'm talking to people who've been down to Cuba and are telling me that it's not as nice as it looks in the videos, I'm having to rethink that. I'm actually going to do something that your listeners will either consider horrifically boring or somewhat interesting in December. I'm going over with my wife to Munich, and we're going to go town by town to three or four of the well-known Christmas fairs.
Wow.
And we're going to see what the locals do at Christmas time and then end up in Prague and fly back from Prague.
Awesome. Yeah.
So it's going to strange places and doing strange things right now on
cool
the bucket list.
So last thing, what general piece of life advice would you give to people?
Oh, don't listen to my advice would probably be the most important piece of life advice. I don't know. I'm reading an interesting book right now about grit. and written by a professor from the University of Pennsylvania. And even if you only read the first two or three chapters, it's worth picking it up for that. And she starts out by talking about some stuff that she's studied and written about and what generates success. And she's basically says it's not as much intellect as it is perseverance and passion. And when I think about that, I've had the good fortune to be passionate about what I've been doing for the last 30 years. But I think if I had a piece of advice, it would be read her first couple of chapters and think about the things that you're passionate about and willing to persevere on. And if you're not doing something in line with that today, tweak it a little bit, modify it, nudge it in the right direction, because life's a little too short to be doing something you don't enjoy doing.
Great stuff, Brink. So Brink Dickerson, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Brock.